Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear an important interview. And we're going to take a break today from the national surveillance state, various wars around the globe, and domestic politics to talk about fundamental issues related to men and women. We're going to talk with Rob A. Okun. He is the editor of Voicemail magazine and the editor of a new book, a collection of essays called Voicemail, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. And we're going to talk about a lot of current events and how they reflect on the role of males in particular. This program is made possible by the listeners who support me with their subscriptions. People like Bill Goodacre, someone with the initials DGL, Bob Donjakour, and Andy Krieger. I'd like you to join their ranks. You can get a subscription, a 24-hour pass for $1. Our monthly rate is $5, but you're welcome to contribute more. You have an option at $10 or $20 if that fits your budget. And our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. For new annual subscribers from the continental U.S., I've got bonus gifts, including this powerful new rock and roll CD by John Dist called Red Flag. And I've got a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans supplied by our friend Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. It's yours for a new annual subscription. Sign up today at peterbcollins.com. The other way you can support us is to take advantage of the free one-month trial offer from audible.com. Follow the links in the banner ad at peterbcollins.com. And when you sign up, Audible will give you your free audiobook download absolutely free. You can cancel within 30 days. You won't owe them a penny. But in any event, Audible will reward me for referring you with $15. So it's an easy way for you to click around, generate some support for the show that doesn't come out of your own wallet. Is that perfect or what? From the Peter B. Collins Tax Deductible Music Archives,
now when I was a little boy,
Bo Diddley gets us going today.
At the age of five, I had something in my pocket. Keep a lot of folks alive. Now I'm a man, May 21. You know, baby, we can have a lot of fun. I'm a man, I spell M.
Today we explore what it means to be a man in 21st century America, what it means to be a pro-feminist male, and the work that I have to say I've been surprised to learn about, that many men have been doing quietly since the sexual revolution and the feminist movement surfaced in the United States back in the 1970s. We're joined today by Rob A. Okun. He's a longtime gender justice activist, editor and publisher of Voicemail magazine, and of course, mail is not spelled M-A-I-L, it's M-A-L-E. And there's a magazine, there's a website, voicemailmagazine.org. org. Thank you, Rob. And they have just published a powerful new book that Rob edited called Voicemail, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. Rob, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
Well, and I'm happy to explore these issues. And as I mentioned to you before we started recording, I feel a little bit at a loss because of the rich diversity of voices that you present in your various outlets, and it was drawn to my attention by this new book. Give us a little background on the pro-feminist men's movement in America, if you would.
Sure. A lot of men were fascinated, drawn to, confused by, afraid of the women's movement as it was coming into prominence in the 60s and into the 70s, recognizing in our guts that something was really wrong in how women were treated. And even if we had some kind of inner clock going, oh, right, women didn't get the right to vote until 1920. Geez, that was too bad. But now they do. Even if we had that awareness of the long history that, earlier generations of feminists might have had, we were kind of on the outside. We didn't quite get what it was like to be the less than, the oppressed, the victim. We were just walking around in whatever level of understanding of the world and our place as maybe young social justice activists thinking about the civil rights movement or thinking about the anti-war movement, but we weren't really thinking about women's roles. So when women finally declared in no uncertain terms that we are now going to move forward in a movement for our own liberation, it caught a lot of us off guard. And some of us tuned out. Some of us kind of ignored it. And some of us said, let me check what's going on here. So hesitantly at first, men began to explore what it is that women were looking for. And part of it was, the phrase that the women's movement popularized, the personal is the political, actually was something that men hadn't considered at all, because we could be great activists out in the anti-war movement or the civil rights movement, but expecting to come home to a hot meal. And slowly, and all the other kind of stereotyped, father knows best, Ozzie and Harriet Nelson, all of these images from the 50s. I'm sure that even if younger listeners are not remembering these exact television shows, that they are certainly aware of the messages from that time. So men began to, in some cases, figure it out a little bit on their own and start to read some of the early works that were coming out, going as far back as Eddie Friedan's The Feminine Mystique, and books like by Susan Brownmiller and Andrea Dworkin. Mm-hmm. But a lot of us were slow. We didn't quite see the connection. And it was only when women started to talk to us, if you want to be helpful, if you want to really pay attention to what you're doing, the most important issue that's coming up for us is violence against women. So the early involvement of men in this movement was really standing with women who were challenging, the very earliest beginnings in the battered women's movement and sexual violence against women.
Mm-hmm. Men, now, I'll return to that in a moment, because okay. it is a critical focus of the work. But let's first start with the guys here, Rob, because it strikes me, and some of this is refreshed by looking at the book and seeing all these various voices of mostly men speaking up on a whole range of aspects. But to me, the fundamental work starts with men about maleness and the fact that, we are, in general, the oppressors of women. And if there is going to be any liberation of the female sex, it seems to me that it has to start with a new frame and worldview for most males who grow up inheriting a pretty retro view of sex roles.
That's right. For a lot of us, it really, I'd like to say that we came to this on our own, that we figured it on our own, but the truth is that, you know, women said, the way the things are working, it's just not right. There isn't a level playing field. And whether or not it was through the economic door of recognizing, you know, that women were earning, 77 cents to the dollar, or whether it was through the reproductive rights movement where men were becoming aware of the restrictive laws around abortion and birth control, all of these issues, which sadly they've resurfaced now, and both the pay equity and women's health rights are still under siege. But once the door was opened, once any of us who had a commitment to social justice, once we were presented with the facts, it was kind of indisputable that we had to take a stand. And I think that there's probably more men who, if you ask them, you know, some basic questions about fairness and equity, who would end up having to acknowledge, well, I guess I could be described as pro-feminist. I never thought of it that way, Rob, but I think that more of us are inclined in the direction of letting some of the privilege and some of the entitlement that we've inherited, for no other reason that we arrived on the planet in male-identified bodies. And now, you know, so many things are shifting in the culture, the changes that we're seeing across the board on a lot of social issues. It's really past time, but I think with a book like Voicemail, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement, maybe there's an opportunity to invite more men, and particularly younger men, to join in this work.
It's very useful. You open the book with what you describe as a short history of pro-feminism. And in relatively brief blurbs, you describe an array of groups that sprung up in the 70s and 80s, and many that are still going today. Men allied nationally for the Equal Rights Amendment, the Oakland Men's Project. I'm just leafing through here. Raven. Mm-hmm. Raven is a group in St. Louis. Emerge, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Man Alive here in San Francisco. The Men's Resource Center for Change, where you are in Amherst, Mass. Men Stopping Violence in Atlanta. The White Ribbon Campaign in Toronto. Real Men in Boston. And, you know, it's really fascinating to see how these groups really appear to be organically local, yet you provide a kind of network through the magazine, the website, and now this book, so that we have a sense of what is truly a national presence.
That's right. And that it's emerging from under the radar is a good thing. And one of the indicators to me that we are coming out from under the radar is there's a number of places to go, but just in terms of what's just been in the news and people, you know, were paying a little bit of attention to in the last couple of weeks was the comments that first the vice president and then the president made about sexual violence on college campuses in particular, and the roles and responsibilities that young men have to both not perpetrate such acts, but also, more importantly, because there's only a minority of perpetrators, but to be no longer bystanders, but to intervene in a whole host of ways that would demonstrate an evolving and a transformative nature of men's consciousness around issues of fairness. One of the more amazing stories. There's a college campus. This gives you a sense of where a movement like this could go. When there's been some sexual assaults on campus, often the university responds by increasing the amount of lighting at night and offering van service to take female students from their classes or their dorms to whatever activities they're going to. College, and it's escaping me in the moment, flipped the whole notion on its head and said, why would we be having the women take these vans? The women should be free to walk around the campus. Anytime a man is leaving campus to walk across anywhere, we'll give him a ride. We'll take him. And then that gives the men get a ride, and then those who might want to be the perpetrators are now happily inside a van with other men, and maybe there's a conversation that goes on. But it's just, it was such a refreshing notion that we need to be addressing these issues from a range of perspectives.
But Rob, deeply offends my sense of chivalry, and that predates any awareness or any evolution to being a pro-feminist male.
Exactly. And that, you know, I think individual by individual, what our notions are of what is chivalrous and you know, how we want to be treated. I think we all want to be treated respectfully. And if that means that, you know, I open the door for you and you open the door for me, that's fine. But I think, you know, what women are really asking of us as men is, I think there's more to your emotional interior life. I think there's more to your humanity than the message that you've been given. And I think this, for me, and if this is a good place to continue, really looks at, you know, how do we get to a consciousness around supporting feminism? And I think, for me, it began by recognizing what we've, a lot of us call the man box that we've been socialized to exist in. You know, the box that begins when the 2 or 3 year old boy falls down and scratches his, you know, his knee, and it's, you know, he hurts and he gets up and he goes running for comfort. And the message that he receives is the one that we all heard at one time or another: big boys don't cry.
Mm-hmm.
And when his sister falls down and the same things happen, come here, honey, let me pick you up and hold you and cuddle you and snuggle with you until you feel better, and let me remind you that you're safe and I'm going to be here to protect you. And happily, we're in a moment in the culture and in many communities around, you know, the country and lots of places in the world where that other message isn't being delivered as regularly as or as forcefully or for as long, that we are comforting and nurturing our sons.
Well, Rob, I think that is very important, and it operates against the overwhelming noise machine that promotes aggression, male dominance, boys will be boys. And let me come back to the subject that you raised a moment ago about the president's, and I applaud him for raising awareness about sexual assaults on campus. But he is the commander-in-chief over a military organization that permits, condones, and turns a blind eye to tens of thousands of sexual assaults that occur now annually. And we have a military that is out of control. And while there was all this hand-wringing over lifting Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and allowing gays to openly serve in the military, it provided a smokescreen for a horrendous crisis that has emerged that affects not only women. There are many male victims of sexual assault in the military today. And as you and I are speaking, today the court-martial begins for the 82nd Airborne's General Jeffrey Sinclair. And he is accused of having a long-running affair with a female subordinate. You know, that is an inappropriate power relationship to start with. But when she tried to break it off, You know, this is based on the news accounts. I want to be clear that I don't have any direct evidence or testimony, but the case that is presented is of a man who used his authority to force a woman who wanted to be his former mistress to continue to service him sexually. And that is a standard that unfortunately sets a tone for the entire military, and I think unfortunately helps us understand the pervasive nature of this problem.
Right. Well said. And I think that one of the, you know, the upside of all of that is how the scandalous behavior within the military has, you know, every month, every 6 months, every year over these last several has become, the layers are being peeled off more and more, and you're finally getting people in positions of authority, you know, both within the military and in the Senate. I'm thinking of Senator from New York,
Gillibrand,
mm-hmm. Yeah, who was championing the legislative redress.
And let me add to that, we have a courageous congresswoman from California, Jackie Speier, who for a time was giving a one-minute speech every day on the floor of the House about a case of sexual assault in the military. Yet we saw Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri close ranks with the Old Boy Network, led by Carl Levin, the retiring senator from Michigan. And they colluded to prevent the real reforms that Senator Gillibrand was promoting, essentially to take the prosecution of sex crimes out of the chain of command control, because there's been so much abuse of that discretion, where people who have committed sex crimes that in secular society would have given them a 20-year sentence, and they either got a slap on the wrist or just a note in their file. And so this is an issue where, in my view, while there has been a substantive debate about it over the past year, too many men have remained silent. And this is where I think your book is important, because you give us examples of hundreds of men who don't remain silent in the face of obvious criminal behavior or moral wrongdoing.
Right. And thank you for that. And I am one voice among, you know, many, many voices that have been at this for decades. I mean, we really, this movement really did get its legs. The earliest organizations were in the later 70s. So the moment that we're at now is there are enough men who've put their foot in the water to speak out, that it's making it a little bit more easy for those men who, through their silence, through their not challenging the kinds of behaviors and crimes that you've just outlined, that now more men are starting to speak out. Now more men are ready to move from being a bystander to an activist. And not everyone has to do that 24/7 for there to be the kind of shift, but we do need to see more men speaking out. And we need to, of course, you know, hold female political figures who get caught up in the Old Boy Network, you know, for other political strategizing of their own. We've got to, you know, hold their feet to the fire too. This is a movement for freeing people from the heinous crimes of sexual assault. I mean, the dots are now getting connected. The treatment of boys as victims of sexual abuse that got exposed most dramatically in the recent years through Penn State. But those of us who've been paying attention to what sadly has gone on in the Catholic Church for too long, where a minority of priests have been perpetrators. It took our greater religion, the religion of college football, and Penn State no less, to get a national conversation started about the the abuse of behavior that was perpetrated on boys.
That is an important point, Rob, and a sad commentary. But, you know, I've been covering the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church for over 15 years now. And you are correct that it was Penn State and the, you know, the grisly crimes that were exposed there that really galvanized public opinion on a level that we hadn't seen. There are too many people. I just did a powerful interview with a survivor of priest sex abuse, a former nun named Mary Dispenza. And it was really hard to even ask her to retell her story that at the age of 7, as her mother was at the parish office two doors down the hall, the parish priest raped her in an auditorium. And, you know, the crimes themselves are very hard to process. But then we see the Fraternity of the Roman Catholic Church running a long-term cover-up. And to this day, you know, even the new pope, who deserves credit for a very different tone from the seat at the Vatican, he's not confronting the sex abuse scandal. And he recently, while the UN was conducting its hearings on the cover-up at the Vatican, Pope Francis was co-celebrating a mass with Roger Mahoney, the discredited former Archbishop and Cardinal of Los Angeles, who ran at the direction of the Vatican and the preceding Pope, formerly known as Cardinal Ratzinger, the ongoing cover-up of the abuse in Los Angeles and the movement of priests from one parish to another. And so it's mind-boggling that there is still such widespread denial and a failure of good people, men and women of all kinds, to just say this cannot be tolerated, even under the color of religion.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, what we're sharing here is that there's plenty of work to be done, and we need more men to embrace this kind of consciousness shift that gives us the permission to challenge respectfully but assertively, to challenge any of the men in our lives whose behavior is anywhere on the continuum of abuse. And this is why if we hear that conversation, you know, between neighbors that seems that it's crossing the line from an argument to abuse, that we really have both an obligation and an opportunity to step in and to speak out. We can't allow, you know, issues like, you know, domestic violence to go unchallenged in our communities. Fortunately, we can point to a shift over the last generations where police are getting better trained from the message of what goes on behind closed doors is none of our business to, you know, we're going to presume that there was a crime here, and we'll, you know, we'll be more responsive about restraining orders, and we're taking this issue seriously. But whether it is in someone's home or whether it's in an institution like the military or the church, it's incumbent upon us not to sit back as men and say, "Well, you know, I got lucky. I got to have the most privilege and the most entitlement of anybody, and particularly, you know, if I'm not a man of color, if I'm white, well then, you know, I've hit the trifecta, and I don't have any responsibilities. You know, good luck to the rest of you." And actually, the most surprising development for many men who start to let go of, to loosen their grip on that power and privilege, is how liberating it is to be part of a greater community of people all looking for ways to live in an egalitarian community and an egalitarian society. That when women step forward and said, "We're pushing open this door to go for our liberation, we're going to go for our full expression of our humanity," there was nothing on that door that said women only. Mm-hmm. We were invited, encouraged, if we wanted to grow as human beings, to look at the things that are holding us back, to look at the things that are that we're blind to in terms of how we've taken advantage of our privilege and entitlement, and to recognize that there's a lot of positives in being part of creating something instead of just assuming that we're supposed to be in charge.
Mm-hmm. Rob, I'm glad you raised the scourge of domestic violence. For the last year or so, I've been volunteering in support of the Family and Children's Law Center here in my community. And as a result, I shot some video interviews with some of their clients. And it's just this grim reminder that domestic violence really knows no boundaries. I live in one of the most affluent communities in California and in the country. And one of the victims I talked to met her abuser at AA. And, you know, they were both, you know, kind of trying to rebuild their lives. And she went on a 5-year nightmare with this guy. And I won't go through every step, but what was even most bizarre is that after he was sent to state prison for violating a series of restraining orders, he still would orchestrate harassment of his former partner by getting friends to report to him on where she'd been and who she was with. And his obsession with that control is something that is unforgettable. And so I'd like to turn here to the work of men's groups in addressing the disease of violence, and in particular, when it is visited on lovers and family members, because it's a really critical set of issues, and I don't believe that law enforcement is really the solution.
No, it's you know, a tool, but we really have to go back to the whole, you know, how males are socialized and where that you know, the power and control that men exercise, and that belief in, you know, the going way back as, you know, women as property. You know, we've come a fair pace in challenging those notions of what that kind of conventional view of power and control. But we're, you know, from the incidents that you cited in the military and in the church, we still have a long way to go. But if we want boys to grow up not to become, you know, domestic violence abusers or sexual violence assailants, then it really is incumbent upon us to start to raise boys with different messages. And I think that some of these initiatives that are starting to happen that are directly linking how we raise our sons and what we expect from them in terms of their behavior in sexual relationships is part of the solution. And the ways that we think about boys, the double standard that we have where, you know, someone who is called a stud as a young man, that's considered a positive, and someone who's called a slut as a woman is considered a negative, when we recognize that, you know, the healthy expression of one's sexuality and the healthy erotic connection between people enjoying themselves and their sexual lives is something to be celebrated. But we've still got these double standards, and we still have this message that's kind of skewed in one direction. And for those of us who do identify as pro-feminist, it can sometimes be a little daunting to want to speak out about some of the behaviors that the culture, the pop culture, the movies, everything tends to present the message as I was outlining it, that, you know, stud equals cool and slut equals, you know, not cool. Not good.
And Rob, how successful are men's groups that engage in group therapy around sexual extremes, around violence and dominance? How successful are they in more or less rewiring the socialization of these males, some of whom are offenders, who participate in these programs under court orders?
Well, that the work, I can certainly speak to the work with men who are in batterers intervention groups. I led groups like that for many years here in Massachusetts, and it's very challenging work to get deep enough in that in 20, 30, or 40 weeks you can affect behaviors that have been ingrained for 20, 30, or 40 years. So I start from that awareness that it's very difficult, and that the culture within a group often could challenge the best intentions of a group leader by, you know, making sarcastic remarks about some of the curricula. That said, there are men who show up in these groups who had a wake-up call, whether it was their spouse saying, here's an ultimatum, you either do a group like this or I'm out of here, or those who crossed the line legally and were ordered by a court to be mandated to a group. It didn't matter. In our groups, they were mixed. We didn't have a group for one or the other. We just had everybody together. And the biggest shift was when a man had a wake-up call and said, I don't want to lose my family. I don't want to not have a relationship with my kids. If I need to look at this, I need to look at this. And one of the easiest ways to get a guy to say, to backpedal on his story, it's like, oh, I just flew off the handle. I just couldn't control myself, is to say, is that how you act towards your supervisor at work? You somehow manage to keep it together at work so you don't lose your job. Why do you feel like you can behave that way towards your partner, in a heterosexual relationship, the woman you profess to cherish? So when you say a message like that, oh, right, huh, I guess I could manage my anger when it came to my boss. I felt like belting him. I felt like screaming at him, but I didn't want to lose my job. Why do I feel like it's okay to act out towards her? So those are the little chinks in the armor that we start to, you know, work with. But it's among the most challenging work that there is to undo those deeply ingrained patterns. Your listeners and you'll be happy to know, in the same vein as learning about this book, Voicemail, a colleague last fall came out with a book called Unclenching Our Fists, Abusive Men on the Road to Nonviolence, in which she features a dozen stories of men who have been in recovery from abusive behavior for many, many years, some of them staying in their groups for a long time. That kind of work is really, really challenging, and we need good news around it. We need to feel that any man who's motivated to change can, recognizing that it's a long haul, and you've got to really have a deep commitment.
Rob, I understand the statistics of particularly sex offenders. At the same time, I have been an advocate for innocent convicts, and I've seen cases where people were falsely convicted of crime. And so at times I'm torn when people make a presumption that if you commit a sex-related crime once, that you are overwhelmingly likely to reoffend, and therefore very extreme draconian measures such as, you know, having to register for life as a sex offender. And there are gradations of crime, yet the law often is just triggered by whether it was a felony conviction or not. And so I'm just curious as to your view as to the efficacy of these very tough, often zero-tolerance laws that really don't allow for the specifics of an individual case. and end up tagging these people with the proverbial scarlet letter for life. And that, in some ways, causes them to reoffend, because if they are perceived as lower than, a lower class person, then that affects their self-esteem, and it can lead to a pattern of recidivism that might otherwise have been broken up.
No question. We have to revisit, some of the rigidity in these laws, and we have to have some room for, making adjustments. Most of these laws, just like the domestic violence restraining orders, most of these laws, their coverage is good. If they're 85-90% effective, then in any measure, we feel, more than satisfied as a society, except if you happen to be in that 10 or 15% who are unjustly being targeted. So creating environments and regulations where there's more latitude for the justice system and the movements towards reconciliation and alternative dispute resolution, that we find other ways to work. No question that that's valuable.
Mm-hmm. We had a pretty big scandal here in San Francisco about 2 years ago. The newly elected sheriff, even before he took office, had an altercation, an argument with his wife. And he bruised her arm, and it's a very complicated story. At one point, she went to a neighbor, and the neighbor shot a videotape that was then kind of leaked to the public. Anyway, it became quite a case. The mayor tried to get the sheriff fired. He was not successful. And the reason was that the Ethics Commission that had to weigh the issues, couldn't come to a clear conclusion that a crime had been committed. And it falls into this gray area. But there were many people from the domestic violence community who just immediately assumed maximum guilt on the part of the sheriff. And his wife, came to his defense publicly, said that she didn't want to press charges. And so it became very complicated. And I got kind of isolated from the activists because I took the position that we weren't there and we didn't have enough information to say, exactly what happened and what level of culpability there was. And, these things now play out in a very public way. You get Nancy Grace on television issuing her verdict even before a jury has been impaneled. And I just feel that in some ways we've tipped the balance a little too far, and that while I fully support the efforts to protect victims and potential victims, that we have to protect the rights of the accused as well.
No question. These are complicated, and these certain stories have become public, and that one certainly did get some legs. We certainly heard about it out east.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to look at another aspect of where men's voices would be well served in being heeded a little bit more, and that's in the area of mass shootings that we've mm-hmm. experienced in recent years.
Yeah.
And part of the work of a lot of my colleagues in the pro-feminist men's movement has been to add another dimension to the conversation around gun violence that has happened as a result of the mass shootings. And when these mass shootings happen, most vividly in recent memory would be Sandy Hook, the school in Newtown, Connecticut, in December of 2012. We are shocked once again that it's happened. And we look at the access to guns, and we make our efforts towards gun control, and then we're shocked at how the mental health issues of, the individual shooter have gone undetected or underdetected, certainly with the shooter at the Aurora the movie theater in Colorado, and we put our emphasis on better mental health screening. So we have these two legs of the stool, mental health and gun control, and that stool won't stand if we don't look at the third leg, which is the gender of the shooter. And those of us who've been working in this field, both in the pro-feminist activism and the anti-violence activism, have been amazed that all of these shootings later, going back at least as far as Columbine, that nobody in the national media, nobody in government ever speaks at any length or with any detail about the gender of the shooter, and that, you know, whether it's 61 out of the last 62 or 66 out of the last 68, that these shooters are all men. And what are we going to do about socializing our boys and raising our boys so that gender is part of this conversation? Because it's not an accident.
And well, Rob, you raise a very important point, and you did so in a rational and coherent way. The problem is it's very difficult to have a rational, coherent conversation about gun violence because the Second Amendment extremists, in my view, will not tolerate any discussion that leads to any efforts to curtail access to weapons or to require, you know, further registration or training. And so this is a very, you know, perhaps the most difficult cultural issue that we face in this country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the, you know, the guns and the violence that gets perpetrated, you know, they're not the ends in themselves. I mean, people aren't attached to guns just because they're guns, and violence isn't glorified just for the sake of violence. They're used to do something as a means to an end. I mean, you know, the guns and violence are instruments of control, you know, whether they're used by the state or by an individual. And I think, you know, whether it's a government or a hunter or a batterer or a schoolyard bully, a corporation, I mean, this is that long thread that connects all of these pieces. You know, I mean, our culture is saturated with images of violence, football, field, video games, you know, but that's not the work of the, of kind of a lunatic fringe of violent men. It's all flowing from this obsession with control that shapes every man's standing as what it means to be a real man in the society. And those of us who just feel like that's a crock, you know, we've got our work cut out for us.
And Rob, in the book, you have a whole section about fathering. And this is a critical component of exactly what we're addressing right now, is that either there's negative modeling from fathers who carry pathologies and pass them along to their sons, but there's a greater problem of fathers who are absent via divorce or because they're incarcerated, and the impact that that has on the offspring. And I was particularly struck by this essay called Father Hunger, written by Mumia Abu-Jamal, who talks about his own memories of his dad. And when you look at the studies, what you see is a direct link between absent father figure and various social problems that develop in boys, teenagers, and men.
You're right. You're right. I mean, that's a whole piece of the puzzle. Is, you know, recognizing that it happens, and it happens more frequently than any of us would like, that there are these boys and girls growing up without dads. But in terms of the connection that a father and a son can have, I mean, Obama referenced it the other day in talking about this My Brother's Keeper initiative, mm-hmm. you know, how growing up without a father, how angry he was. And, you know, it isn't a prescription that if you grow up without a dad that you're going to, you know, turn out to have a difficult life. but it certainly increases those chances. And so the notion that men can find their way in to, whether it's being a big brother or, you know, that organization, Big Brothers and Big Sisters, or finding some way through coaching or mentoring to be a positive force in a boy's life growing up, these are critical developments. And I think probably one of the easiest portals for men to enter into this work is through those of us who are fathers or get involved in some aspect of mentoring, because what that does, and this is really, I think, one of the more important points of our conversation, is we get a chance to access our innate ability to nurture and to be compassionate and to be, finding that gentler, more open-hearted part of ourselves. And even though some aspects of the culture are telling us, if you act in a nurturing, open-hearted, compassionate way, those are all adjectives that we would deem feminine, and then you are less than a man. The cultural shift that I see is that we're actually beginning to celebrate men who are finding that part of themselves. And we're actually looking at the word, you know, nurturing in a different light, that it isn't just something that is women's domain, mm-hmm. that it's actually something that's good for us.
A lot of great voices in this new book, edited by Rob Okun, called Voice Male, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. Rob, as we wrap up, I want to draw you into one other recent controversy, and that is the public exchange of accusations by Woody Allen's daughter, Dylan, and Mr. Allen himself, brokered by the newly tabloid New York Times. And I was uncomfortable by, you know, the whole thing. I respect Dylan Farrow's experience and what she has described. And at the same time, I don't believe that I'm in a position to judge Woody Allen. Which is not to say that I exonerate him or anything of that sort. But even on Facebook, I got into some very difficult exchanges with mostly women who simply take the position that it is a cut-and-dried fact that Woody Allen abused his daughter, and that they use a lot of irrelevant information, such as his relationship with Soon-Yi Previn, essentially just to smear Allen. And this is where Nancy Grace comes back in, where it's like the entire nation was sitting as a jury in a case that was not properly before us. And so those are the feelings that I wrestled with around this, and I'd just like to hear your thoughts.
Well, in some regard, I mean, my first response is, in the time that we have for our interview, this isn't something that, you know, I want to spend time on.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, because it's off the topic. The fact that there are men who have behaved inappropriately in their in abusing children sexually, we discuss that, and we have the cases of Jerry Sandusky and the priests in the church. It's true, we don't know what happened, we weren't there, and any time a famous person gets an allegation made about them, it becomes news. And if it's a figure, you know, a cultural figure, we're interested. But the larger question for me isn't, you know, what happened. The larger question is, you know, what are we going to do about a society that it happens,
mm-hmm.
regardless of who the perpetrator is? And, you know, having children growing up in households where the adults there are healthy and connected to their hearts, that's how we're going to have, children who are becoming flourishing adults and not damaged by the you know, the violence and the abuse of perpetrators, regardless of who they are.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Rob, I want to thank you for joining me today. I really enjoyed this conversation. I want to recommend that people visit your website, voicemailmagazine.org. Be sure to spell mail, M-A-L-E. And the new book, edited by Rob A. Okun, is Voicemail, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks very much. I appreciated it.
Hey, guys. I think we got some work to do. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again.